At this point, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Lance from Sunny Lake.
All right.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Lance, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomers and the people with birthdays. You know, my sobriety date is April the 10th of 1988. I didn't choose that day. God chose to pick me up out of the gutter and quit doing the things that I was doing on that day. And I don't remember giving him permission for that day. But I just know that the longer I stay sober, the more that I'm available to listen to a higher power of my understanding. And I went back to my roots as a child, and it's worked tremendously well. You know, things beyond of my wildest dreams have happened to me, you know. I didn't think that I was going to be in a brown robe when I got sober. I thought that I was just going to be working on cars and transmissions for the rest of my life. But then, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the responsibilities that it gives me, it tells me to be honest in all my affairs, and those things just unfolded because the company that I stole transmissions from and the cast aluminum transmissions from when they weren't no good and I didn't think they needed them in this pile. I got paid on Wednesday. I was broke on Friday. I went to the recycling center on Saturday and I got more money to drink on the weekend. And I didn't think they'd miss that money. That was my decision. And that's where my alcoholism took me, you know. What I thought I deserved, I took, you know, and my sobriety date is April the 10th of 1988. And it's just amazing what can happen. I always start out with this little prayer. It's let your God love you. Be silent, be still, alone, empty, before your God. Say nothing, ask nothing, be silent, be still. Let your God look upon you, that is all. God knows and understands. God loves you with an enormous love, wanting only to look upon you with love, quiet, still, be. Let your God love you. You know, I grew up in a family and it was normal and they loved me, took me to church, taught me the right thing. Sometimes I didn't think it applied to me. And I always tried to see what that other side of that fence looked like because I had alcoholic tendencies to run with this group of brothers that did not so honorable things. We stole, ran with the group, and I had the consequences that went with that. You know, first time I got in trouble for drinking when I was in the eighth grade, and I was at the Christmas party. Thought I needed to be accepted some more by this one group, and I took the whiskey from the house that I was living in, put it in the peanut butter jar, and it went from the peanut butter jar into the Kool-Aid at the Christmas party at the school. You know, I didn't get caught. My friends who I was hanging around with got caught. They got caught for doing the drugs and everything, and so they ratted on me. And so I got 2 weeks on top of the 2 weeks. You think that would have been a lesson there, you know, not to hang around with the wrong crowd. No, that wasn't for me then. I didn't know by the consequences of my actions and my consequences would have to match one another in order to get the results that I have today. So we went from Alameda, California to Oroville, California. Went from a town of about 25 or 30,000 to a farming community, you know. And if you just don't quite fit in from the city life out to a farming community, because I go with, you know, in the early 70s, it was bell-bottom pants and flared jeans and plaid pants and the wild shirt and everything, and it took me a while to fit in there, you know. And it just didn't do that. It took me a couple years to do that until I started to excel in sports and football. It was football and track and swimming. those things I accelerated in. And then when I became popular, I started getting invited to these parties. And I've always been the one, no matter what condition the head was in, if I was drunk, if I was sober, I always acted independently. When I was hungry, no matter what time it was, night, 11, midnight, there's places that are open that have food. It was time for me to stop drinking and go get something to eat. I didn't tell people where I was or when I was just like, boom, time to go and get something to eat. Just like when we were out of booze, it was time to go get something to eat, get something to drink. And I did that a lot. I did that with women, too, when the alcohol was low. That was unimportant over here. The alcohol was more important than the women in my life. So I did that, too. And so when I did that, I would end up in places where I wouldn't think that I would normally end up, in bushes, behind people's houses that I didn't go into, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then when I woke up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and it was time to go, I didn't wait for my ride. I was 5 miles outside of town in a farming community, and I walked back to home. And my friends would say, how'd you get home? They'd call me the next day, how'd you get home? I walked. Walk. You should have waited for us till the sun come up. I didn't have that much patience. I didn't have a lot of patience in a lot of things that I did in life until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went into the Navy right out of high school, and that's when my drinking really took off, because I ran wild. And I went in as an E1, got out as an E2. Anybody who knows anything about military service knows that I should have got out as an E3, no, should have got out as an E4 or an E5. Well, I took those tests, but I got busted for my intoxication. Being drunk on duty was one of them, and the Navy didn't appreciate that. The military doesn't appreciate sleeping. I was on board the ship, and I fell asleep on watch, and they didn't appreciate that. But they knew I was a hard worker once I didn't drink, because I went to the captain's mess like 4 or 5 times or something like that, and they could have very readily gave me a dishonorable discharge. But I got out with the good of discharge, honorable conditions. So I got out by the skin of my teeth. But they didn't want me to reenlist. They knew that I was unrealistable, you know, based upon my history. And they didn't even ask me. So I said, okay, I was all right with that. And my dad, my mother, and my father always told the truth to me. My father looked at my Navy record, and he says, am I proud of my military service? And I said, no. Because I was told, when my father would look at me in a direct way, I always gave him a direct answer, and that's what he taught me, and I still have that value today. You know, if I know the answer and it's true, the truth really, if I know the truth and it's twisting inside of me, I have to let it out and tell another alcoholic what's going on. You know, but my mother and father never abandoned me. Through the 5 DUIs, they were the only ones that came and bailed me out of jail at 3 o'clock in the morning. No matter where that was, 45 minutes away, and they were living in Ogden, Utah, and I was drunk in Salt Lake City, Utah. They'd come and bail me out of jail. It wasn't the people who I was drinking with. I was living with 3 women at one time, and then April came and visited me when I was living with those 3 women, and they said, well, we don't approve of what you're doing, and that was their choice, but I was an alcoholic, and I was a man, and I thought I could handle that. But when it came to me being the only working with a paycheck, responsible paycheck in my hand, I thought I was doing the right thing, and the women could do what they wanted to do, and just as long as I was the life of the party and everything was working well. But one morning I came home from work and working on diesels. I was working on diesel trucks at that time, and I came home and my stereo that I got in the Navy, I had it for like 10 years at that time. That was gone. The stereo, the TV that I rented from the rental shop was gone. The refrigerator was gone that I rented from the rental shop. And there was one thing that belonged to the landlord. It was gone. Everything, and the women were gone too. So So some of the women came back, they said, we'll rent a place from you, because I said, this is it, this is enough for me. I'm bailing out of here. And they said, we'll rent it. I said, no, I want clear cut, no strings attached, out. And so that was the end of that part of my life. And I never saw them women again. And that was in Ogden, Utah. And I hope I never repeat that part of my story. And so I went back and I was still working on trucks, and then I started going back to transmission shops and in and out of the jails and everything. I have 5 DUIs altogether. I don't know if I mentioned that, but it's either 3 in California or 2 in Utah or the other way around. And the judge told me, I came in here, you know, I came in here in 83, I went to the VA center, in 85 I went to the VA center, and it was H&I that planted the seed, hospitals and institutions that planted the seed, that tiny little mustard seed that I didn't throw any light on. No light, no water. I didn't think I was ready. I was 23 and 25. No light was in that tunnel yet. I had my, and each time that I came out, I repeated the same thing. I hung around the same people. Eventually, I got drunk. Eventually, I got a DUI. It started with drinking water, drinking Coke, drinking the Crown Royal with the Coke, drinking the Crown Royal straight out of the freezer, blackout drinking, the drugs and the alcohol all mixed together, the same thing, the same pattern. And then finally in 87, in October of 87, I remember this, and this is the reason why I came in here. I came in here out of fear, because the judge said the next time that you come before me, I'm not sending you to jail, you're going to prison, because obviously the jail's not working for you, and you're not getting my message. You're not getting my message. And so that was a wake-up call, but I still had to do some controlled drinking from October till April the 10th of 1988. And when I quit drinking April the 10th of 1988, I went to a lot of meetings. I sat in the back of the room, read the 12 and 12 at a treatment center. They had a big book study. I went to the big book study, read that. And finally, at this one meeting that I was going to, it was a Tuesday night Valley View group. It was at 8:30, and I'd come in, I'd have clean coveralls on, but I'd bypass the shower because I didn't want to miss anything that you guys were going to tell me. So I'd be bypass the shower. My hair was down to about back here, you know, and it was this all full of grease and oil and everything, and I didn't care what I looked like. I was showing up. I was showing up to what was being said here in these rooms. And then in that meeting, I got one of my first two sponsors, and he said, come and sit with the adults. So I went from the back of the room to come sit at the table with the adults, and I didn't know what that was going to involve. I didn't know what they were going to ask me to do. I was just following the directions because I knew that fear of prison was still in the back of my head. That was the wake-up call, like I said, for me. And when I got that, and then I was doing what they were doing, they were going to lots of meetings, service commitments. My sponsor took me to a lot of service meetings, and first he gave me GSR, and I didn't like that commitment because it was too argumentative, too many alcoholics and one idea, and a lot of smoking and a lot of yelling at those meetings, and I didn't like that because I wanted a calm presence, you know. I wanted the calmness to calm down because there was enough noise going on in my head still. And then finally, my first sponsor, he gave me a coffee committee commitment. A coffee committee, yeah, that's what it was. It was supposed to be a committee. A coffee commitment at this great outdoor campout. And he says, you're going to need some help. And I said, no, I won't. All weekend long, fix the coffee, you know, for the all the alcoholics drinking coffee all weekend long. I said, no, I won't. He says, yes, you will. So we went along with that, and I went and go picked up the coffee. And I was I was awake all day Friday, all day Saturday, till about 7 o'clock at night. And so by that time, my energy level was down, but my energy, adrenal level started to drop, and I said, I need to go take a nap. So I took a nap till about midnight, and then I woke up and I made some more coffee. So finally, when we got off the mountain, I got home at 5 o'clock at night, and then I slept from 5 o'clock at night, 5:30 at night, until 6:30, 7 o'clock the next morning. I was wiped out. That's where I got the idea. I better pay attention to my sponsor, because let him do some of the thinking for me. You know, and even though he knew that I was enthused about the program and I had the desire to quit drinking, but I still wanted to do things on my own. As a result of that, that's what happened. And he was always there for me. And then when I moved to Ogden, I had another sponsor, and he was part of my spiritual program. He took me to this monastery up in Huntsville, Utah, of Trappist monks. And the first time that I'm there, 5 months sober? Yeah, 5 or 6 months sober. And they stick the new guys under the bell, as I find out. Well, the monks get up and pray at 3 o'clock in the morning. The bell goes off. Lance goes from, okay, the bottom of the ceiling's here. Lance's bed's here, and it goes like that. And I felt like I went up. I jumped right up there because the bell goes off, and what are you supposed to do? No time to get up and pray. You think it was time to get up and pray, but I tried to go back to sleep, but I couldn't because the head was running around at that time, first time there. And then all of a sudden, I went to go see what the monks were doing. They were out there praying already at 3 o'clock in the morning, quiet and still, silent, chanting the psalms, praying to the God of Jesus, praying to Jesus. And I said, oh, I'd like to do that. But I didn't know how that was going to take a form. I just said, I'd like to do that. So I went up there on my own and got more experience and slept. I slept in a different bedroom at that time. They gave me a different bed away from the bell, so I didn't jump up. And I was grateful for that. And I got to do that quite a bit. You know, and you really get to know, in my experience, you really get to know a sponsor when you do things together, when you're one-on-one with that sponsor. I worked on my sponsor's transmission at his house. We pulled it out, my friend fixed it, and I put it back in right as his car. He's a painter, worked on his transmission. We ate dinner with him right there on the spot. And then my other sponsor, he was an air conditioning refrigeration. He came over and worked on my heating and air conditioning. I gave him coffee, and we talked about the program and his life experiences. And it's different when you're out here than when you're one-on-one and it's only you and him or you and her. You know, it's just totally different. And that formation and that bond that we get with another human being that I did not have when I was drinking and using. That never happened. It was, what did you have, and I want what you got, and can we share? And sometimes they'd say yes, sometimes they'd say no. But when I walked away and my bottle was gone, I know where it went. You know, it went out the door down the street with that person who I didn't give permission to. And so at that time in my sobriety, I had three commitments, and I did the International Conference of Alcoholics and Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous. That was in 1989, and I was on the registration committee. Once again, I had no idea what a computer looked like, what it did, you know. Not my sponsor at that time, but the chair of the committee said, come on, I'll show you. So I learned about computers in 1989. And I got to do those things, and we worked in the committee together, and we got to do registration. And that whole weekend, once again, I slept a little bit because I did have a little bit of experience that I couldn't be there for everything all the time. So it was about being present at meetings, marathon meetings, all the time in downtown Salt Lake City. And it was great to have all the people of the world and share their experiences in different languages and everything. And conferences are great. And the 4th of July barbecue, what other alcoholics can be doing at that time. Because early on in sobriety, I was going to CA meetings, AA meetings, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, because I had lots of energy that I didn't know what to do with. Lots of energy. You know? And then I started getting out of self. When I was working the steps, I got to the fourth and fifth step at 18 months of sobriety, and I asked this priest, because I was trying to kill two birds with one stone, tell another alcoholic, another person, what was going on, and tell them my past and get it out there. And so I says, okay, I haven't been to confession in a while. And I also, doing what the program suggests, you know, and I said, Father, will you listen to my fifth step? Okay, let's go. So I was ready. I had it all formed out there and everything. And this time I'm in his hands, right? The other person's hands, and I've got to do it his way. And so I had it all going on there, and I was reading all my character defects and all my problems, and he says, pause. And in my head, I said, what's that about? It doesn't say anything about pausing, or what am I supposed to be doing here? No pausing. That's what I want to do. No pausing. So we prayed. So he prayed. We had a little prayer going on. He says, okay, continue. Same thing. Keep going on. Okay, it's time to pause. So we prayed some more. So I got used to that. We prayed about 3 or 4 times. And we were in the back of the church, open spaces and everything. So I just got it all out there, what was on my piece of paper, and he had patience with me. And the thing that I walked away from that was, if I sit and pray and meditate about it, I'm not apt to repeat those things on that piece of paper again. I don't have to ever do that again. Those horrible things which I had a lot of shame and guilt over, and there was a big weight on my shoulders until I did that, you know. And so far, up to this point, I haven't had to do those things that cause shame and guilt, not only for myself, but those other people that I dragged down with me, that I didn't think that me being an alcoholic, self-centered and self-seeking, that I never have to do that again. And so I went along, and when I paused and I went home and I did 6 and 7, I was having a problem with that. And so my sponsor says, you're having a problem. I mean, when you're around another person long enough, people can read you. And I was all right with that. And he says, are you ready to have God remove all the defects of character? And I said, yes. Okay, next. That's all he said, next. I was pausing more time in my head than I was, you know, actually doing it. And then, did I want him to humbly remove my shortcomings? Yes. Okay, next. So now I was ready for 8 and 9. Mom and Dad's first one up on the docket for 8 and 9. We're looking at a basketball game. Triple overtime. I wanted to get it through I had it in my head. I went over their house. We're looking at the basketball game, and by the time the end of the game goes, I thought I was all ready, and the guy makes the basket. Okay, overtime went there, so it went overtime. Anxiety's building up. Anxiety. No patience. Anxiety. Second overtime. Bing. Can't say it yet. Well, game's not over. Third overtime. Okay, game's over. Turned off the TV. I said, Mom and Dad, I'm sorry for all the times that I've hurt you. Kept it simple, right to the point. And they said, we know. See, by that time, I had enough sobriety under my belt. They saw my examples of what I was trying to do to improve my life, to make my life better, to do the things, to show up on Thanksgiving. Because sometimes I had a problem showing up for Thanksgiving, because the day before Thanksgiving, I'd get drunk and didn't know how to get on the bus, or didn't have a driver's license, and I was too sick to get there. I show up to Christmas. I show up to fix the car when my dad asked me to fix the car, because he didn't want to bring it to the shop, because he had a son who could fix the car responsibly and put the right parts in there and just do it on the weekend when I worked on cars all week. And I went down the list, and I trusted the sponsor enough. That's where the trust in the sponsor. You talk to the sponsor, you go down the list, and he said, "Oh, nope, you don't want to do that one yet. You don't want to do that one yet." And one person I had to wait till he passed away, because when I quit drinking this time, I had a clear dividing line break. I had no reason to be around the people who were still drinking, who were still having guns pointed at them, who were still doing those things that they needed to do. And then I came over here to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and like I said, it was a clean break, and showed up. And I was handing out sandwiches to the homeless, and that twisted my heart. That was before I entered religious life. And that spoke to me. The guy in Salt Lake City, it's snowing on Christmas Day, and all the guy wants is a bologna sandwich, and I try to give him a place where there's a hot meal and everything. All he wants is a bologna sandwich. No, that's all I want. Can I come back later? Okay, you can come back later for just a bologna sandwich. Or the homeless family that needs an apartment, we could hand out vouchers for that. And I was able to see my life in another context there. You know, how important it is to support the family if I make that decision. You know, because I was still deciding between married life and religious life then. And my mom and dad knew what I was doing, and my sister understood a little bit. But other people in Alcoholics Anonymous knew what I was doing. I was just doing that 180 turn that we talk about. And I was in prayer and meditation. I was in prayer and meditation one day, and I was in Mass, and I was before Mass, and God said, "Come follow me," and my eyes opened up, and I didn't know what that meant. Didn't know what that meant in 1992. And I was trusting the inner voice back then, but how quiet it gets when I do trust that inner voice and it's directing my thinking. And when God said, "Come follow me," I didn't know what that meant. And a week later, a vocation director shows up for the Dominicans, and they were all white. And I says, I knew what God wanted me to do. I want to work on poor people's cars with drug addicts, alcoholics, and in soup kitchens. That's all I wanted to do for the rest of my life. They said, "We don't do that, but these people do, Capuchin Franciscans." And I said, "I want to work with drug addicts, alcoholics, soup kitchens, and on poor people's cars." They said, "We do that." He says, "Okay." I didn't know what it was going to take. You know, I didn't know what it was going to take. I was just saying yes to what God was asking me to do. And stay sober and be able to make a decision. You know, quietly make a decision on the inside and follow the inside. And so in 1994, I was still going to meetings. I was still going to lots of meetings back then and doing what I was supposed to be doing and working the steps. And when I finally, I've been a Capuchin Franciscan ever since 1994, and I've been able to help my father pass away, my uncle pass away. My uncle and his wife, my aunt, they trusted me to be responsible for their estate when they were gone. They said, "Well," I said, first I said I wanted to deflect that on the family, let the family do that. "No, we want you to do that. We don't trust them. He stole from us before." And I said, "Okay." So I did that. And then the day Dad died, I was there the night before. He waited. They called me. I was in California working on a homeless woman's car. And they called me and they said, "You got to come. You got to come." And I was there. And so the night before, I said, "Dad, I love you." That phone wasn't there. "I love you." And he raised up, and heard that. That day after, the day of his death, the day of Dad died, the car broke down at the gas station. I knew what to do. I crawled underneath the car, banged on the starter, and Dad in his voice, in his own voice, he said, "I'm with you. I'll show you what to do." That's me waiting around for the miracle to happen, like it can for all of us, the newcomers and the people with birthdays as well. It happens if we just have patience with the miracle. My brother-in-law's brother, I buried him, who I used to drink with, and I talked about that clear split, you know? And I buried him. He ended up one time in the side of the river, in the Ogden River, and I showed up to his bedside one time, and I said, "How you doing?" He says, "How'd you know I was here?" "Well, my brother and my father's getting the triple bypass surgery in the same hospital as they are, so I went up to his room." And all his friends that he hung out with, and I haven't seen him for about 8 years. He asked me what I was doing. I told him what I was doing. And he told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is for weaklings, and I have to remain weak to remain teachable on a daily basis, because I don't want to know all the answers. I want to still get better. I know I can still get better because it's happening on a daily basis. So when I did the funeral, I gave the eulogy, I gave the invocation, I blessed the casket. Right as soon as I blessed the casket, the people who I haven't seen in 15 years, they started drinking right there at the cemetery. And there was, again, the clear split. I didn't need to go off over here to see what they were doing. I knew what they were doing. And they go, "Where are you going?" I said, "It's time for me to leave. I have enough experience that I know my inside tells me when it's time to leave, when it's time for me to leave in an uncomfortable situation. The quiet comes in and it's time for me to make a decision and go." So I left. It's just time to do that. You know, and my mother, she's 88 years old, and I get to be part of her life, and there's some family conflict going on there, but I don't have to be reacting to the arrows that comes out of the middle from my one sister's side and my one sister's side. That happens in Ogden, Utah. It doesn't happen here in California. I don't have to be part of that. I'll let them throw the arrows if they want to. If they want to go through some healing or something like that, I'm there for that. I'm not there for the arrow throwing. I have a sponsor that I still talk to today. I just talked to him in Santa Barbara when I was outside and relaxing, and he's got like 33 years. My one sponsor, he's in Florida. He's got 47 years. I talk to him once a year. Maybe my other first sponsor, he's got 47 years. And he's the one that took me to the monastery and showed me the way, led me along, showed the beggar where the other beggars are. You know where the other beggars are. You know, step 10 tells me to take continued personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admitted it. In my job, I get to do a restraint and pen and tongue a lot, because I'm on the phone with copier people. I'm on the phone with dishwasher people. I'm on the phone with a lot of people who say they're providing that service to me, but sometimes I feel that if I give them a 45-minute window, I give them that window. And if they say, "Well, we forgot," or "We got busy," my phone's working and I was right there, or they have my cell phone. I make sure all my people know my cell phone number. And I go, "Okay, I'll give you one more try." And I say sometimes to them, "Are you too busy to come see me?" No, I'm not too busy. I don't have patience in all things. And when it comes to that record, because there's, in my capacity as bookkeeper in charge of 3 checkbooks and overall plant manager, there's 30 other people that I'm responsible for. that to make sure the plant is running smoothly, that the dishwasher's working, that there's food in the refrigerator, that there's other things that happen around that plant. So how I go from a drunk on the street to being in the gutter to being flogged in the jail cell to be the responsible person over here is through Alcoholics Anonymous. Is through Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only way that happens, and I have to remember what got me busy. I can't forget where I came from. You know, I can't forget about Ogden, Utah. I can't forget about Salt Lake City, Utah, the times that I was locked up in jail. You know, on my last birthday, it just coincided with my person that saw me walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they brought me my 26-year chip from Utah. And we had Chinese food in Santa Ynez, California, and he gave me my 26-year chip. He goes, here's your chip. And I went, wow. So that was like way cool. You know, that you still have these friendships after so long. You know, these friendships that just keep getting better. And last year, when I was home, and he knew that I was coming home, he was on the phone with the secretary for the old timers meeting. First time I've been called an old timer, you know. And he says, we need a speaker for the old timers meeting. Are you available on that day? And I know to him, I don't say no. So I said yes. So we went out to dinner. There was a group of us that went out to dinner. And I spoke at the meeting. At the first place where I remember sitting in the back of the room, and I was sitting at the AMBO speaking for 25 years. And some of the people that I saw come in the room were there. Some of the people that I saw come in and out of the room were there. You know, it's just amazing that all can happen. And sometimes I go to treatment centers in Utah, and I still people that I've seen come in the room with me, they're in the treatment center once again. This program works if you work it. In my experience, it's not a free ride. It doesn't come by osmosis, you know. It doesn't come by somebody putting a book on your head. It comes from people who ask to, when you speak, I want to say thank you to Stan for asking me to share on Tuesday. He asked me to share. I said, I knew what he was getting to. I said, do you want me to speak? And he told me, and I just said, where? What am I need to do? And I, where? Okay, here, no problem, 7 o'clock Sunday. Here I am. You know, what time do I go to?
Whatever.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not done. Anyway. Okay, step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. That's something that I value. The God of my understanding and the conscious contact. I get to do that on a regular basis twice a day. 6:30 in the morning. I always get in the chapel about 5:45 with my cup of coffee, and I'm coming to God. Coming to, I don't need the light on the tabernacle. I know where God is. I don't need any directions there. I just need to sit there quietly and listen. Quietly and listen. And learn by other people's examples like I did with the monks. And I get to be around some cloistered nuns that I learned from their example of sitting quietly and just gazing. In my experiences, the wonders of God and what He does in our lives and what He's done in my life and where He's brought me from and where He's bringing me to, I don't know. Where He's bringing me to, I don't know. And that's an evolving theme in my life. Where He's taking me, I don't know. If I say yes, I get to help the homeless in the streets of Santa Barbara. The homeless in Santa Maria, I don't know when that comes. If I'm available, I can say yes to that. Step 12, it's taken me through the jails and the psych wards, the psych ward in Utah. And I was in the psych ward in Utah my first few years of sobriety, and I was taking a meeting there, and I was visiting somebody in there. And sometimes when I'm in the psych ward, I'm not sure if the person's actually comprehending what I'm trying to say, or because he's under the drugs and everything else that they give you in the psych ward. And, And I was at a meeting one time, and he came up to me and he says, "I really appreciated you coming and talking to me. I'm here today because of you." And it's not because of me. It's because of those things that were freely given to me that I'm able to carry the message to the alcoholic still suffering. To the alcoholic still suffering. You know? And in the jails, it was an amazing ride. I was doing jails and hospitals. When I was in the, going to jails, that they one time we were doing the H&I meeting in one part of the jail, and the jailers came around and running around over here to this side of the jail. I didn't see what was going on over here, and then all of a sudden they announced lockdown and everybody back in their cells. So they had to get done with the meeting. They put everybody back in their cells, and we had to stay put. And I said to myself, "We're going to be here for a while. We're going to be here for a while." And so once they took care of everybody else who was supposed to be there, they let me and my friend out. And that didn't happen when I was drinking. That was not happening when I was drinking. It was, "You're going to be there and stay. You need to stay for a while." So it was like an hour and a half or so, you know. It's always no big deal. You know, and they let us out, and it was an amazing thing, because the first time when I was making out my form for H&I, I thought that they were going to find something that I did in a blackout. And they were going to say, "Lance, oh, you need to stay here for a while, and we're going to keep you because you did this and this and this." And there would have been no way that I could contend with that. I mean, I had no argument for that. You know, I would have just said yes, and that's it. So they let me out, and they continued to let me out, and I kept on going in there. And when I was doing hospitals, I was doing judgment on this woman one time, and she was in a detox, and I thought she was pregnant, and I thought she was carrying her kid into detox and drinking with the kid inside of her. That was her liver sticking out that far. And she shared that. I didn't have to ask her what was going on. She shared that. And my heart just sunk. My heart just sunk. One last story. And I'm grateful. My brother, who only has a third of his heart working because of the disease that we used to drink together. When I go home and I see my brother, there's Lance, untreated Lance, and I get to see that when I go home. He was in a homeless shelter in Colorado Springs in 1997, and my sister says, "My brother's in a homeless shelter." First thing, what does the program of Alcoholics Anonymous tell me to do? And my God tells me, "Do. You need to go out there and get him out of the homeless shelter." That was my plan. I had a car. I said, "Come on, the family loves you. Let's go to Utah." And he said, "No, I got a plan." Well, that sounds like just like me when I was drinking and using. I got a plan too. You know, I didn't know what that was or how that was going to evolve or anything, but I had a plan. A month later, Mom and Dad sent him the bus ticket. He goes back and sleeps on Mom's Dad's couch, gets to bed. 7 months later, he's having his first triple bypass surgery, his heart attack while he was working. And I thanked God for that, because if he would have had the heart attack in the homeless shelter, he probably would have died. You know, so when God asks me into action, I don't question why or what the consequences are. It's just a boom. And sometimes it's good. Sometimes I have ramifications from that. "I didn't want your help." Sometimes that comes about too. The homeless people, "Do you want a sandwich?" "No, I want some sauce." "Do you got some sauce?" I said, "No, I can't help you with the sauce. But I can help you with the sandwich if you want it." "No, I don't want a sandwich." But the fact is that my brother had a safe place to stay when he was recovering from his triple bypass surgery, and he had another one after that because he still drinks and smokes after that, and he cut back on his drinking, he still smokes. But I don't have any control over that. I don't have any control over other people's lives. I just have to think about Lance not taking a drink one day at a time. A loving God that knows Lance, and Lance has a working relationship with a God of my understanding that I didn't have before because of this program. Because of this program, one day at a time. And I have a chance. I have a chance one day at a time because of this program. You know, so I hope the newcomers stay. I hope the people with birthdays stay. I hope people who are thinking about if they're alcoholic or not stay. Because if when I honestly looked at my past and reviewed my past, I stayed. Because when I got here, I thought I only had 18 months because of my probation was going to be up and the threat of the judge and the fear was over. And then I looked at my pluses and my minuses, and my pluses had more than my minuses, and I had a regular driver's license from the state of Utah that it's been renewed by the state of California twice by mail. I didn't have to go in and take the test. That's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And me just showing up and doing the next right indicated thing from a loving God, from my understanding. So thank you.
Thank you, Lance. Let's give him another hand of applause. I'd like to thank everybody who has echoed them in and those who helped get this meeting organized. And the speaker will be available after the meeting. And Francine, can you lead us out into prayer?
I almost pounded on it a couple times.
Yeah, it would have been okay if you did.
Thank you.